Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance with extra benefits like personal accident cover.
It's been over 30 years since George Hamilton uttered those famous words, "The nation holds its breath," in Genoa, as Ireland made it to the last eight of the 1990 World Cup. George was the storyteller for some of Ireland's most prominent sporting achievements, from Ray Houghton's breakthrough against England in 88 to Dave O'Leary's crucial penalty kick against Romania. Well, in his memoir, "The Nation Holds Its Breath," George recounts his most memorable moments as a broadcaster from his early days in the BBC to his career in RTE, and he joins me now in studio. Morning to you, George.
Good morning, Miriam. Thank you for having me.
Great. I've really enjoyed the book. I know nothing about football and I enjoy this very much. Listen, when you voice those famous words during Italia 90, "The nation holds its breath," how did you come up with the inspiration for this line?
It's almost impossible to say, because when you're in a comedy situation, headphones on, microphone clasped to your mouth, you're very aware of what you're doing. You're following the action, but you're trying to add to the action without stating the obvious. And when you get to a situation like that where the tension is ratcheted up, somewhere in your head are swirling around thoughts and ideas that will crystallize into something that you hope will be appropriate at the moment. And the story of that moment is quite simple, really, because I'd been told in my ear when it got to the shootout that the 6-1 News, which was on the air at the time, would also be taking the pictures from Genoa. And bear in mind, they told me, this won't be a holy football audience, so you'd better be careful what you say. Don't take anything for granted. So that was fine. So I've been told this, and we're going through the penalties, and Tom Flanagan, my sidekick, who was the most amazing assistant to have
really
on the road, a great guy, retired floor manager. Tom was beside me, kind of edging further and further forward on his seat as this went on. And then he heard the message that I got and he said, goodness me, this is big, this is big. And so we're watching it evolve, and then it comes to the point where it's Romania, last kick, Bonner saves, and this kick can decide it all. I could almost say it all again because I've heard it so many times, because it was the 30th anniversary last year. Anyway, we've got to this point, and it's in my head that there are no other television stations other than RTE1 and Network 2. TV3 hadn't come along yet. So if anybody's watching television in Ireland, they have to be watching these pictures, this moment. And it was just, you're aware as a commentator too of how the shots change, the cut from the director from one thing to the other, and you tailor your commentary to match that so you're not filling the air with verbiage when the picture is telling the story. And this picture was telling the story because it had become so dramatic. And David, it's on the back of the book, you know, David O'Leary bending down to put the ball down for the penalty kick. And there's that moment when the tension is right up there. And there's got to be one comment, only one comment, because the picture is going to tell the story. And what could the comment possibly be other than, everybody's watching. Everybody in Ireland is watching. The nation holds its breath.
Oh, it's absolutely superb. It's, you know, but when you're a live broadcaster, it's those moments that matter. And then you said, we're there.
We're there, yeah. Yeah, I know. There was nothing else to say. The ball hits the back of the net and we're there. We're there. And there was such a, you know the pictures, obviously, the dam bursts and they all rush onto the pitch. And it's just, it's one of those moments that is etched in the memory and will never go away.
Go right back, George. I'm interested. Tell me about your upbringing in the North.
Yeah, well, only child, born in 1950, which is only 5 years after the end of World War II. A lot of people from Belfast had been away serving in the forces. My father was in the Royal Air Force, but he only got as far as York because he had a bad knee, and so he couldn't go into combat. But out of that, a lot of people then would have gone back into Civvy Street, as they called it, and would have done their best to set themselves up for a better life after the 6 years of turmoil. And that involved getting the mortgage, buying the house. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself on a suburban street, Rochester Avenue in East Belfast, which features in a lot of panorama shots of Belfast because it's just below the Castlereagh Hills. And you get a great view of Napoleon's Nose and Divis and the Black Mountain. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, the two Samson and Goliath, the cranes at Harland and Wolff. So it's there as a kind of establishing shot for Belfast, this street of about 100 houses that sweeps down. And we lived in one of them, a three up, two down semi on one side of the road. We were on the the west side of the road. We had a long back garden that the sun shone into, and that was my father's pride and joy, was this garden. He had the most immaculate lawn, and he grew vegetables down the end, and the hedges were immaculately trimmed. And this on this road were lots of people like him, families headed by men who had served in the war, who had come home and had saved up and were starting their families. And there were lots of them, like mine, those families, only children. Which was a reflection of the times that were in it, because times were tough, and it would have been the old Ulster Scots pragmatism: don't fill the house with children because it'd be too expensive.
Yeah, interestingly. But you were really close to your dad.
Yeah.
And he was a good footballer.
Yeah, he played for Cliftonville in the 1930s, and although I've never managed to track it down, apparently in the sports paper, The Iron Saturday Night, he appeared on the front page because he scored a hat-trick on his debut, and they put his picture on the front page of The Iron Saturday Night. But he was obviously well-gotten in the club, because, like, that 20 years after he was a player, he was taking me back, and everybody knew him. So he obviously made some kind of an impact there. But I don't know that he ever played representatively. I'm sure if he had, there'd have been a programme or something to show. Mm. But he did play in the Irish League, and he did actually, comically enough, play on the same pitch that I played on as a rugby player at Methody, because the grounds where Methody have their sports facility was once the grounds of Queen's Island, which was the sports facility of the Harland Wolff Shipyard. And the first 15 rugby pitch was Queen's Island's football pitch, and he would have played for Cliftonville against Queen's Island, a now defunct football club. But I was play there rugby for Methody.
So interesting. Tell me about your mom.
She was a typical Belfast housewife who had a job but ran a home as well. She was a bookkeeper for a man called Willie John Harper, who had a timber business, Arthur Morrow's. And it was through her and her work. He gave her an old typewriter for a Christmas present from me, because I was absolutely fascinated from an early age with print and journalism and newspapers. And she would have worked Monday to Friday there, and then on Saturday she worked for her father in his bakery. He had a home bakery, as they call it, on the Woodstock Road in East Belfast. So she worked 6 days a week. A very, very kind and generous woman, but a woman with a very strong Presbyterian streak of what is right and what is wrong. So there was no deviation in any sense, and it was off to church every Sunday morning and Sunday school every Sunday afternoon, because that was the way you did it.
Were you aware growing up, or even at the beginning of your career, George, about, you know, the difficulties living in Northern Ireland? Were you aware of them as a young boy, aware of sectarianism or not?
Well, looking back, yes, of course, because with an adult's eyes, you can see what the situation was. But through a child's eyes, the only thing that was obvious was that in number 43, there were the Devlins, and they were Roman Catholics, and they were the only Roman Catholics on the road. So there was something. And the very fact that this would be noted was something that pointed to the fact that things were not maybe the way they would be elsewhere. But having said that, the life that I had as a kid was perfectly normal, because I laugh about this when I hear it mentioned about the 15-minute city, because I lived in one. Everything was 15 minutes away. School was 15 minutes away. Town was 15 minutes away. Everything was close at hand. And in none of that 15-minute orbit did I come across anything as a child that seemed in any way abnormal. So it was a charmed childhood, yes. But looking back with an adult's eyes, you can see that things were not the way they should have been.
But interestingly, reading your book, you were fascinated by the Republic of Ireland. Mm. You were fascinated by us,
yeah,
weren't you?
I was, absolutely. And I have no idea where that came from. Though I perhaps have my father to thank, because he was a country boy. He came from Irvinestown in County Fermanagh, where his father was a land steward. And his father, he often recalled how his father, you know, this is me in newspapers, his father took the Freeman's Journal. And I went, what was the Freeman's Journal? Well, that was a paper at the time, but it's gone now. Mm. And so if you think of somebody taking the Freeman's Journal in County Fermanagh, their direction of travel was south as opposed to east. And if you think of it too, Dublin's as close to Enniskillen as Belfast is. So why wouldn't it be like that when it was all one on the island? So I think there must have been something of that came in my genes, if you like. Yeah. And then when we got a car, and it was the thing to do to go on holiday in the car, it would be to Donegal or down south. And that then opened up a whole vista, because it was different. It looked different. It felt different. The post boxes were green, you know, all this. And because it wasn't home, it was it was something exotic. And I wanted to know more and more. And when I passed the 11 plus, they gave me, my parents gave me a transistor radio as a present for passing the 11 plus. And on one end of the dial, there was 208, Radio Luxembourg. But if you spun the dial the other way, you came to a station identifier that said Athlone. I said, where is Athlone? And then I found out where Athlone was, bang in the middle of Ireland. So I would listen to that as well. And I have vivid recollections of lying in bed at night listening to the radio. It wasn't Radio Luxembourg on this occasion because there'd been an election in Ireland. And I was listening to the count from East Clare, which was unbelievably fascinating because I didn't know what proportional representation was. It was something that was unheard of up north. And this was a constituency that had never been near. It was all so exotic and different and fascinating. That was the thing. And I wanted to know more. And then we had this teacher at school, Bilko Gray. He looked like Sergeant Bilko off the television. And he gloried in putting across Irish literature, O'Casey, Singh, and the rest, and Joyce. And so when he went into Bilko Gray's English class, and I took English to A-level, it was just magical because he transported you and he loved it. And so all of these things happening together. And then one fine day coming down to Dublin to play a rugby match and go off to Lansdowne Road for the first time in my life and being on a double-decker bus in from the B&B from Harold's Cross and the guy beside me, Jerry Sillery, saying, you're at your granny's. And I'd never heard this phrase before either. We were out, we were free, we were in Dublin for a Friday night. It was just magical. So I don't think it's any surprise that I've ended up here.
So you've ended up here. How did you end up in broadcasting? I know a woman called Joy Williams in the BBC was very important to you, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was the assistant to the head of sport or the sports programmes organiser in the BBC at the time that I joined. I didn't know her, but I had an aunt who worked there who was a pretty serious player, obviously, because she got to sign the BBC cheques when her boss was on leave. Okay. But I figured that she might be a way in for me. And she said she was a pretty strict lady, Isabel. And she said, yeah, I'll get you an audition because they do those from time to time. But if once the audition takes place, you're on your own. I can do no more for you. So fair enough. Yeah. So I got the audition. I did a report. My heart sank when they told me we don't want any football broadcasters because we're overrun with them. But we'll take something else. So I thought, well, I'd played rugby at school. I'll do that. And I went in with my report to do the audition. I'd gone to a match to do a match report. And the lady who was looking after that audition was Joy Williams. And she obviously heard something in there, in that opening audition. Because although I left with the famous old payoff, you know, don't ring us, we'll ring you, they did ring. And once they started to use me, she was on the case every time. And the way she introduced me to Bill McLaren on the touchline in College Park for a one-on-one with the top rugby commentator the BBC had, who'd no need to talk to me at all. But obviously, if this was Joy's boy, he was going to make sure that he did his best for him. And it was the same with Cliff Morgan, the great Cliff Morgan, who was the head of Radio Sport in London at the time. Cliffy really respected Joy, so if Joy was putting somebody forward, it was going to be, should be a good one. And I got the most wonderful grounding in the BBC. And of course, I think it has stood to me over the years. But RTE has given me such amazing opportunities over the years to take advantage of that wonderful grounding that I had.
And how did you end up working here?
Here? Well, that was quite the story because I'd gone to try and be a freelance sports reporter in Belfast, and there wasn't that much to do in sports reporting in Belfast at the time. The sports department, the BBC now, is a cast of thousands, but then there was virtually no broadcaster employed full time. So I was trying to get going in sport, and I'd started the commentary thing, and I thought there might be a chance to get some work with RTE, and I wrote Fred Cogley, the head of sport at the time. I wrote him a letter. The reply I got was astonishing because he was basically offering me a place on the trip to the World Cup in Argentina. And I could just see what happened because they reckoned they needed four commentators to cover the vast area that was Argentina. Mike Horgan was the away team leader, and he had got Jimmy McGee, Philip Green, hired Billy George from what was then the Cork Examiner, and was pondering as to who he could get next. And I can just see Fred Cogley emerging from his office with this letter saying, here's the answer, here's the answer.
Talk about good timing.
Yeah, that was the best of
timing. And also he was a lovely man, best of timing.
Yeah.
There's some great anecdotes in the book as well. I mean, you met so many notable names. You met, obviously, Paddy Doherty, Johan Croft, George Best. You also met Pele.
Yeah.
What was it like meeting him?
It was astonishing. He was the nicest man. We were in a queue to check in at Mendoza Airport, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And you know, sometimes these people like Frank Sinatra don't want to talk to you, but Pelé was delighted to talk. And he didn't have great English, but he knew why I was there with my lanyard on, with my laminate for the World Cup. And I still have his autograph, Pelé, su amigo Pelé, your friend, Pelé. Yeah, lovely, lovely memory.
Now, you had a good relationship, didn't you, with Jack Charlton? You got on great with him.
Yeah, I knew him before he ever was ever the Irish manager, because when I was over in London working, BBC had the pick of stars to act as co-commentators, men like Frank McClintock and Dennis Law. Worked with a lot, Tommy Doherty. And Jack was between jobs as a club manager at the time, and he did several games with me. And so he knew me, and I always got along well with him. And in fact, it was RTE who told him he'd got the job as the Ireland manager, because when the announcement was made in Merrion Square, the FAI had no way of getting in touch with him. And it was Stephen Alkin, my colleague, and myself, who, through the offices of the late Jimmy Armfield, got to Jack's wife, Pat, who said he's not here, but he'll be here in the morning, and we'll make sure he goes into Newcastle, the BBC, and appears on your programme. So we were the ones who told Jack he'd got the job.
That's incredible. Yeah. The interesting thing is, though, you've this wealth of sport experience, but you've also been 18 years on Lerwick and 16 years writing your great column in the Irish Independent. Where did your interest or love of classical music come from?
That had been my mother, determined that I would learn to play the piano. And that was started about 6 or 7, and I went through the grades at that. And when it came time at the age of 14 to settle on subjects for what was the O-levels then, what would be the junior certificate equivalent, one of the subjects I took, because it fitted the scheme of things, was music. And there weren't many. I think there were 8 in the class. And the teacher was the head of music, Henry Willis, the organist at the school. And he just imparted this great love of classical music, because we studied scores, as you would. And then it just opened the door to what was really behind great music. And with all this classical repertoire behind me, although I was like any other teenager and I followed, you know, the charts and all the rest, and was a great fan of the Hollies in particular, that I still had this thing going on in the back of my head, even when it wasn't kind of fashionable to be doing that. And playing the cello in the orchestra as well sort of kept that going too. So I had this reservoir of classical music rolling around in my head from when the time came and I got the break to go on to Lyric. It was like opening a door into a brand new salon, if you like, where all the musicians were playing, and it was just wonderful. And Aidan O'Doul, who gave me the gig in the first place, said 90 minutes like a football match, play the music you like and just tell us where you've been. And that's what it grew out of and grew into. And it's just carried on like that. And it's now on twice at the weekends, you know. So and it's an absolute joy and delight to do it, because it's with Michael O'Kane helping me choose the music, and then off we go down whatever. And the listeners help choose the music as well. When I start, I never know where it's going to finish, which is a great thing.
And your enthusiasm on it is infectious. And you've kept that in sport as well. Like, I know next Thursday, Ireland play Portugal.
Yeah.
And you're covering that.
Yeah.
Is it as exciting for you as it's always been when you started out as a young reporter?
Oh, yes. I mean, obviously some matches are bigger than other matches, but every broadcast is as big as the previous one or the next one. And I am hugely excited about the prospect of Portugal, because so much hangs on it. Okay, we may be out, but we've matches to play and we can affect the outcome. And Portugal can't afford to slip, because Serbia, and they are at the top of the group, dicing for the one certain qualifying place. So that fella Ronaldo is going to be playing as well. It's shaping up for a wonderful night out.
And it's nice, isn't it? Because at the moment, there seems to be a lot of enthusiasm. About, as I said, I know nothing about soccer, but there's a lot of enthusiasm about this team.
Yeah, well, Stephen Kenny came in with a plan, he said, and there were the doubters who weren't sure how it was all going to go. They did well against Serbia, then they had done well against Portugal. And then, of course, they got their first victory when they were away in Baku. And now this is almost like the one that can confirm that the good has happened and is happening, and the team is on the road to somewhere. If not the next World Cup, who knows what after that? Maybe the Euros in Germany.
Absolutely. Well, we can hope for it. Mm. And listen, George, thanks so much for taking the time to come into me this morning. It's a great read.
Thank you.
For anyone who's even not interested or doesn't know much about sport, it's fantastic, all about your background. It's called The Nation Holds Its Breath, published by Merriam Press, and it's available to buy now. Thanks so much for being with me, George.
Thank you for having me.